rattling mud brick home at night. He would have witnessed for himself the rapidly expanding divide between the absurdly rich and the indebted poor. He would have mingled with the city's Hellenized and Romanized population, those wealthy, wayward Jews who spent as much time praising the Emperor of Rome as they did the Lord of the Universe. He certainly would have been familiar with the exploits of Judas the Galilean, for while the population of Sepphoris seems to have been tamed and transformed after Judas's rebellion into the model of Roman cooperation, so much so that in 66 CE, as most of Galilee was joining the revolt against Rome, Sepphoris immediately declared its loyalty to the emperor and became a Roman garrison during the battle to reclaim Jerusalem. The memory of Judas the Galilean and what he accomplished did not fade in Sepphoris. Not for the drudge and the dispossessed, not for those like Jesus who spent their days slogging bricks to build yet another mansion for yet another Jewish nobleman. And no doubt Jesus would have been aware of the escapades of Herod Antipas, that fox, as Jesus calls him in Luke chapter 13, verse 31, who lived in Sepphoris until around 20 CE, when he moved to Tiberias on the coast of the Sea of Galilee. Indeed, Jesus may have regularly set eyes upon the man who would one day cut off the head of his friend and mentor, John the Baptist, and seek to do the same to him. Chapter 5. Where is your fleet to sweep the Roman seas? Prefect Pontius Pilate arrived in Jerusalem in the year 26 CE. He was the fifth prefect, or governor, Rome had sent to oversee the occupation of Judea. After the death of Herod the Great and the dismissal of his son Archelaus as ethnarch in Jerusalem, Rome decided it would be best to govern the province directly, rather than through yet another Jewish client king. The Pontii were Samnites, descended from the mountainous domain of Samnium in southern Rome, a hard country of stone and blood and brutal men that had been broken and forcibly absorbed into the Roman Empire in the 3rd century BCE. The surname Pilatus meant skilled with a javelin, a tribute perhaps to Pilate's father, whose glory as a Roman soldier under Julius Caesar had allowed the Pontii to advance from their humble origins into the Roman knightly class. Pilate, like all Roman knights, performed his expected military service to the empire, but he was not a soldier like his father. He was an administrator, more comfortable with accounts and tallies than with swords and spears. Yet Pilate was no less hard a man. The sources describe him as cruel, cold-hearted, and rigid, a proudly imperious Roman with little regard for the sensitivities of subject peoples. Pilate's disdain for the Jews was obvious from the very first day he arrived in Jerusalem. Bedecked in a white tunic and golden breastplate, a red cape draped over his shoulders. The new governor announced his presence in the holy city by marching through Jerusalem's gates, trailed by a legion of Roman soldiers carrying standards bearing the emperor's image, an ostentatious display of contempt for Jewish sensibilities. Later, he introduced a set of gilded Roman shields dedicated to Tiberius, quote, son of the divine Augustus, into the temple of Jerusalem. The shields were an offering on behalf of the Roman gods, their presence in the Jewish temple a deliberate act of blasphemy. Informed by his engineers that Jerusalem needed to rebuild its aging aqueducts, Pilate simply took the money to pay for the project from the temple's treasury. When the Jews protested, Pilate sent his troops to slaughter them in the streets. The Gospels present Pilate as a righteous yet weak-willed man, so overcome with doubt about putting Jesus of Nazareth to death that he does everything in his power to save his life, finally washing his hands of the entire episode when the Jews demand his blood. That is pure fiction. What Pilate was best known for was his extreme depravity, his total disregard for Jewish law and tradition, and his barely concealed aversion to the Jewish nation as a whole. During his tenure in Jerusalem, he so eagerly and without trial sent thousands upon thousands of Jews to the cross that the people of Jerusalem felt obliged to lodge a formal complaint with the Roman emperor. Despite, or perhaps because of, his cold, hard cruelty to the Jews, Pontius Pilate became one of the longest-serving Roman governors in Judea. It was a perilous and volatile job. The governor's most important task was to ensure the uninterrupted flow of tax revenues back to Rome. But to do so, he had to maintain a functional, if fragile, relationship with the high priest. The governor would administer the civil and economic affairs of Judea, while the high priest maintained the Jewish cult. The tenuous bond between the two offices meant that no Roman governor or Jewish high priest lasted very long, especially in those first few decades after Herod's death. The five governors before Pilate served only a couple of years each, the lone exception being Pilate's immediate predecessor, Valerius Gratus. But whereas Gratus appointed and dismissed five different high priests in his time as governor, throughout Pilate's decade-long tenure in Jerusalem, he only had one high priest to contend with, Joseph Caiaphas. Like most high priests, Caiaphas was an extremely wealthy man, though his wealth may have come through his wife, who was the daughter of a previous high priest named Annas. Caiaphas likely was appointed to the office of high priest not because of his own merit, but through the influence of his father-in-law, a larger-than-life character who managed to pass the position to five of his own sons while remaining a significant force throughout Caiaphas's tenure. According to the Gospel of John, after Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was first brought to Annas for questioning before being dragged to Caiaphas for judgment. Gratus had appointed Caiaphas as high priest in the year 18 CE, meaning he had already served 8 years in the office by the time Pilate arrived in Jerusalem. Part of the reason Caiaphas was able to hold the position of high priest for an unprecedented 18 years was because of the close relationship he ended up forging with Pontius Pilate. The two men worked well together. The period of their combined rule, from 18 CE to 36 CE, coincided with the most stable period in the entire first century. Together, they managed to keep a lid on the revolutionary impulse of the Jews by dealing ruthlessly with any hint of political disturbance, no matter how small. Yet despite their best efforts, Pilate and Caiaphas were unable to extinguish the zeal that had been kindled in the hearts of the Jews by the messianic uprisings that took place at the turn of the century, those of Hezekiah the bandit chief, Simon of Perea, Athronges the shepherd boy, and Judas the Galilean. Not long after Pilate arrived in Jerusalem, a new crop of preachers, prophets, bandits, and messiahs began traipsing through the Holy Land, gathering disciples, preaching liberation from Rome, and promising the coming of the kingdom of God. In 28 CE, an ascetic preacher named John began baptizing people in the waters of the Jordan River, initiating them into what he believed was the true nation of Israel. When John the Baptist's popularity became too great to control, Pilate's tetrarch in Perea, Herod Antipas, had him imprisoned and executed, sometime around 30 CE. A couple of years later, a woodworker from Nazareth named Jesus led a band of disciples on a triumphant procession into Jerusalem, where he assaulted the temple, overturned the tables of the money changers, and broke free the sacrificial animals from their cages. He, too, was captured and sentenced to death by Pilate. 3 years after that, in 36 CE, a messiah known only as the Samaritan gathered a group of followers atop Mount Gerizim, where he claimed he would reveal sacred vessels hidden there by Moses. Pilate responded with a detachment of Roman soldiers who climbed Gerizim and cut the Samaritan's faithful multitude to pieces. It was that final act of unrestrained violence on Mount Gerizim that ended Pilate's governorship in Jerusalem. Summoned to Rome to explain his actions to the Emperor Tiberius, Pilate never returned to Judea. He was exiled to Gaul in 36 CE. Considering their close working relationship, it may be no coincidence that Joseph Caiaphas was dismissed from his position as high priest in the same year. With Pilate and Caiaphas gone, there was no longer any hope of stifling the revolutionary passions of the Jews. By mid-century, the whole of Palestine was buzzing with messianic energy. In 44 CE, a wonder-working prophet named Theudas crowned himself Messiah and brought hundreds of followers to the Jordan, promising to part the river just as Moses had done at the Sea of Reeds 1,000 years earlier. This, he claimed, would be the first step in reclaiming the promised land from Rome. The Romans, in response, dispatched an army to lop off Theudis's head and scatter his followers into the desert. In 46 CE, two sons of Judas the Galilean, Jacob and Simon, launched their own revolutionary movement in the footsteps of their father and grandfather. Both were crucified for their actions. What Rome required to keep these messianic stirrings in check was a steady, sensible hand, someone who would respond to the grumblings of the Jews while still maintaining peace and order in the Judean and Galilean countryside. What Rome sent to Jerusalem instead was a series of bumbling governors, each more vicious and greedy than the last, whose corruption and ineptitude would transform the anger, resentment, and apocalyptic mania that had been steadily building throughout Palestine into a full-scale revolution. It started with Ventidius Cumanus, who was stationed in Jerusalem in 48 CE, 2 years after the uprising by Judas's sons had been quelled. As governor, Cumanus was little more than a thief and a fool. Among his first acts was the posting of Roman soldiers on the roofs of the temple's porticos, ostensibly to guard against chaos and disorder during the Feast of Passover. In the midst of the holy celebrations, one of these soldiers thought it would be amusing to pull back his garment and display his bare ass to the congregation below, all the while shouting what Josephus, in his Decorum, describes as, quote, "such words as you might expect upon such a posture." The crowd was incensed. A riot broke out in the temple plaza. Rather than calming the situation, Cumanus sent a cohort of Roman soldiers up to the Temple Mount to butcher the panicked crowd. The pilgrims who escaped the slaughter were trapped by the narrow exits leading out of the temple courtyard. Hundreds were trampled underfoot. Tensions escalated further after one of Cumanus's legionaries grabbed hold of a Torah scroll and tore it to pieces in front of a Jewish assembly. Cumanus had the soldier hastily executed, but it was not enough to quell the growing anger and disaffection among the Jews. Things came to a head when a group of Jewish travelers from Galilee were attacked while passing through Samaria on their way to Jerusalem. When Cumanus dismissed the Jews' appeal for justice, allegedly because the Samaritans had bribed him, a group of bandits, led by a man named Eleazar, son of Dineas, took justice into their own hands and went on a rampage throughout Samaria, killing every Samaritan they came across. This was more than an act of bloody vengeance. It was an assertion of freedom by a people fed up with allowing law and order to rest in the hands of a crooked and fickle administrator from Rome. The outbreak of violence between the Jews and Samaritans was the last straw for the emperor. In 52 CE, Ventidius Cumanus was sent into exile, and Antonius Felix was shipped off to Jerusalem in his stead. As governor, Felix fared no better than his predecessor. Like Cumanus, he treated the Jews under his control with utter contempt. He used the power of the purse to play the different Jewish factions in Jerusalem against one another, always to his benefit. He seemed at first to have enjoyed a close relationship with the high priest Jonathan, one of the five sons of Ananus who served in the position. Felix and Jonathan worked together to suppress the bandit gangs in the Judean countryside. Jonathan may have even played a role in Felix's capture of the bandit chief Eleazar, son of Dineas, who was sent to Rome and crucified. But once the high priest had served Felix's purpose, he was cast aside. Some say Felix had a hand in what happened next, for it was under his governorship that a new kind of bandit arose in Jerusalem, a shadowy group of Jewish rebels that the Romans dubbed Sicarii, or daggermen, due to their penchant for small, easy-to-conceal daggers called sicae, with which they assassinated the enemies of God. The Sicarii were zealots fueled by an apocalyptic worldview and a fervent devotion to establishing God's rule on earth. They were fanatical in their opposition to the Roman occupation, though they reserved their vengeance for those Jews, particularly among the wealthy priestly aristocracy, who submitted to Roman rule. Fearless and unstoppable, the Sicarii murdered their opponents with impunity, in the middle of the city, in broad daylight, in the midst of great hordes, during feast days and festivals. They blended into assemblies and crowds, their daggers tucked inside their cloaks until they were close enough to strike. Then, as the dead man collapsed to the ground, covered in blood, the Sicarii would sheathe their daggers stealthily and join their voices in the cries of indignation from the panicked crowd. The leader of the Sicarii at the time was a young Jewish revolutionary named Menachem, the grandson of none other than the failed Messiah Judas the Galilean. Menachem shared his grandfather's hatred for the wealthy priestly aristocracy in general and the unctuous high priests in particular. To the Sicarii, Jonathan son of Ananus was an impostor, a thief and a swindler who had grown rich by exploiting the suffering of the people. He was as responsible for the bondage of the Jews as the heathen emperor in Rome. His presence on the Temple Mount defiled the entire nation. His very existence was an abomination to the Lord. He had to die. In the year 56 CE, the Sicarii under Menachem's leadership were finally able to achieve what Judas the Galilean could only dream of accomplishing. During the Feast of Passover, a Sicarii assassin pushed his way through the mass of pilgrims packed into the Temple Mount until he was close enough to the high priest Jonathan to pull out a dagger and swipe it across his throat. He then melted back into the crowd. The murder of the high priest threw all of Jerusalem into a panic. How could the leader of the Jewish nation, God's representative on earth, be killed in broad daylight, in the middle of the temple courtyard, and seemingly with impunity? Many refused to believe that the culprit could have been a Jew. There were whispers that the Roman governor Felix had ordered the assassination himself. Who else could have been so profane as to spill the high priest's blood on the temple grounds? Yet the Sicarii had only just begun their reign of terror. Shouting their slogan, "No Lord but God," they began attacking the members of the Jewish ruling class, plundering their possessions, kidnapping their relatives, and burning down their homes. By these tactics, they sowed terror into the hearts of the Jews, so that, as Josephus writes, "More terrible than their crimes was the fear they aroused, every man hourly expecting death, as in war." With Jonathan's death, the messianic ardor in Jerusalem reached fever pitch. There was a widespread sense among the Jews that something profound was happening, a feeling born of desperation, nurtured by a people yearning for freedom from foreign rule. Zeal, the spirit that had fueled the revolutionary fervor of the bandits, prophets, and messiahs, was now coursing through the population like a virus working its way through the body. No longer could it be contained in the countryside. Its influence was being felt in the towns and cities, even in Jerusalem. It was not just the peasants and outcasts who were whispering about the great kings and prophets who had freed Israel from her enemies in the past. The wealthy and upwardly mobile were also becoming increasingly animated by the fervent desire to cleanse the Holy Land of the Roman occupation. The signs were everywhere. The scriptures were about to be fulfilled. The end of days was at hand. In Jerusalem, a holy man named Jesus, son of Ananias, suddenly appeared, prophesying the destruction of the city and the imminent return of the Messiah. Another man, a mysterious Jewish sorcerer called the Egyptian, declared himself King of the Jews and gathered thousands of followers on the Mount of Olives, where he vowed that, like Joshua at Jericho, he would bring the walls of Jerusalem tumbling down at his command. The crowd was massacred by Roman troops, though, as far as anyone knows, the Egyptian escaped. Felix's bumbling reaction to these events ultimately led to his sacking and replacement with another man, Porcius Festus. But Festus proved no better in dealing with the rest of Jewish population, either in the countryside, where the number of prophets and messiahs gathering followers and preaching liberation from Rome was growing out of control, or in Jerusalem, where the Sicarii, buoyed by their success in killing the high priest Jonathan, were now murdering and pillaging at will. So overwhelmed was Festus by the stress of the position that he died soon after taking the office. He was followed by Lucius Albinus, a notorious degenerate, swindler, and incompetent who spent his 2 years in Jerusalem enriching himself by plundering the wealth of the populace. After Albinus came Gessius Florus, whose brief, turbulent tenure was remembered first because it made the years under Albinus seem positively peaceful in comparison, and second, because he would be the last Roman governor Jerusalem would know. It was now 64 CE. In 2 years' time, the anger, resentment, and messianic zeal that had been steadily building throughout the land would erupt into a full-scale revolt against Rome. Cumanus, Felix, Festus, Albinus, Florus, each of these governors contributed through his malfeasance to the Jewish uprising. Rome itself was to blame for its mismanagement and severe overtaxation of the beleaguered population. Certainly the Jewish aristocracy, with their incessant conflicts and their sycophantic efforts to gain power and influence by bribing Roman officials, shared responsibility for the deteriorating social order. And no doubt the temple leadership played a role in fostering the widespread sense of injustice and crushing poverty that had left so many Jews with no choice but to turn to violence. Add to all this the seizure of private lands, the high levels of unemployment, the displacement and forced urbanization of the peasantry, and the drought and famine that devastated the Judean and Galilean countryside, and it was only a matter of time before the fires of rebellion would engulf the whole of Palestine. It seemed that the entire Jewish nation was ready to erupt into open revolt at the slightest provocation, which Florus was foolish enough to provide. In May of 66 CE, Florus suddenly announced that the Jews owed Rome 100,000 denarii in unpaid taxes. Trailed by an army of bodyguards, the Roman governor marched into the temple and broke into the treasury, plundering the money that the Jews had offered as a sacrifice to God. Riots ensued, to which Florus responded by sending 1,000 Roman soldiers into the upper city to murder at will. The soldiers killed women and children. They broke into homes and slaughtered people in their beds. The city was thrown into chaos. War was on the horizon. To calm the situation, the Romans sent the Jews one of their own, Agrippa II, whose father, Agrippa I, was a beloved Jewish leader who had managed to maintain a close bond with Rome. Although the son did not share his late father's popularity, he was the best hope the Romans had for diffusing the tension in Jerusalem. The young Agrippa rushed to the holy city in a last-ditch effort to stave off war. Standing on the roof of the royal palace with his sister Bernice at his side, he pleaded with the Jews to face the reality of the situation. "Will you defy the whole Roman Empire?" he asked. "What is the army? Where is the weapon on which you rely? Where is your fleet to sweep the Roman seas? Where is your treasury to meet the cost of your campaigns? Do you really suppose that you are going to war with Egyptians or Arabs? Will you shut your eyes to the might of the Roman Empire? Will you not measure your own weakness? Are you wealthier than the Gauls, stronger than the Germans, more intelligent than the Greeks, more numerous than all the peoples of the world? What is it which inspires you with confidence to defy the Romans?" Of course, the revolutionaries had an answer to Agrippa's question. It was zeal that inspired them. The same zeal that had led the Maccabees to throw off Seleucid control 2 centuries before, the zeal that had helped the Israelites conquer the Promised Land in the first place, would now help this ragtag band of Jewish revolutionaries to throw off the shackles of Roman occupation. Derided and ignored by the crowd, Agrippa and Bernice had no choice but to flee the city. Still, up to this point, war with Rome could have been avoided if it had not been for the actions of a young man named Eleazar, who, as the temple captain, was the priestly official with the powers to police disturbances in the temple vicinity. Backed by a group of lower-class priests, Eleazar seized control of the temple and put an end to the daily sacrifices on behalf of the emperor. The signal sent to Rome was clear. Jerusalem had declared its independence. In a short time, the rest of Judea and Galilee, Idumea and Perea, Samaria, and all the villages scattered across the Dead Sea Valley would follow. Menachem and the Sicarii rallied to the temple captain's side. Together, they expelled all the non-Jews from Jerusalem, just as the scriptures demanded. They tracked down and killed the high priest, who had gone into hiding as soon as the fighting began. Then, in an act of profound symbolism, they set fire to the public archives. The ledgers of the debt collectors and money lenders, the property deeds and public records, all of it went up in flames. There would be no more record of who was rich and who was poor. Everyone in this new and divinely inspired world order would begin anew. With the lower city under their control, the rebels began fortifying themselves for the inevitable Roman assault. Yet, rather than sending a massive army to retake Jerusalem, Rome inexplicably dispatched a small force to the city, which the rebels easily repelled before turning their attention to the upper city, where the few remaining soldiers left in Jerusalem were still holed up in a Roman garrison. The Roman soldiers agreed to surrender in exchange for safe passage out of the city, but when they laid down their arms and came out of their stronghold, the rebels turned on them, slaughtering every last soldier, removing utterly the scourge of Roman occupation from the city of God. After that, there was no turning back. The Jews had just declared war on the greatest empire the world had ever known. Chapter 6. Year 1. In the end, it came down to just 1,000 men, women, and children, the last of the rebels to survive the Roman onslaught. The year was 73 CE. Fitting that what had begun with the Sicarii should end with the Sicarii. The city of Jerusalem had already been burned to the ground, its walls toppled, its population slaughtered. The whole of Palestine was once more under Roman control. All that remained of the rebellion were these last few Sicarii who had fled Jerusalem with their wives and children to hole themselves up inside the fortress of Masada on the western shore of the Dead Sea. Now here they were, stuck on top of an isolated rock cliff in the middle of a barren desert, watching helplessly as a phalanx of Roman soldiers gradually made its way up the face of the cliff, shields up, swords drawn, ready to put a definitive end to the rebellion that had begun 7 years earlier. The Sicarii originally came to Masada in the first few days after the launch of the war with Rome. As a naturally fortified and virtually impregnable fortress situated more than 1,000 feet above the Dead Sea, Masada had long served as a refuge for the Jews. David came here to hide from King Saul when he sent his men to hunt down the shepherd boy who would one day take the throne from him. The Maccabees used Masada as a military base during the revolt against the Seleucid dynasty. A century later, Herod the Great transformed Masada into a veritable fortress city, flattening the boat-shaped summit and enclosing it with a massive wall made of white Jerusalem stone. Herod added storerooms and grain houses, rainwater cisterns, even a swimming pool. He also placed in Masada a huge cache of weapons, sufficient, it was said, to arm 1,000 men. For himself and his family, Herod constructed a monumental 3-tiered palace that hung from the northern prow of the cliff face, just below the lip of the summit, complete with baths, glittering colonnades, multi-hued mosaics, and a dazzling 180-degree view of the briny white Dead Sea Valley. After Herod's death, the fortress and palaces at Masada and the cache of weapons stored therein fell into Roman hands. When the Jewish rebellion began in 66 CE, the Sicarii, under the leadership of Menachem, seized Masada from Roman control and took its weapons back to Jerusalem to join forces with Eleazar, the temple captain. Having seized control over the city and destroyed the temple archives, the rebels began minting coins to celebrate their hard-won independence. These were etched with symbols of victory, chalices and palm branches, and inscribed with slogans like Freedom of Zion and Jerusalem is Holy, written not in Greek, the language of the heathens and idolaters, but in Hebrew. Each coin was self-consciously dated year one, as though a wholly new era had begun. The prophets had been right. Surely this was the kingdom of God. Yet in the midst of the celebrations, as Jerusalem was being secured and a fragile calm was slowly descending upon the city, Menachem did something unexpected. Draping himself in purple robes, he made a triumphal entry into the temple courtyard, where, flanked by his armed devotees among the Sicarii, he openly declared himself Messiah, King of the Jews. In some ways, Menachem's actions made perfect sense. After all, if the kingdom of God had indeed been established, then it was time for the Messiah to appear so as to rule over it in God's name. And who else should don the kingly robes and sit upon the throne but Menachem, grandson of Judas the Galilean, great-grandson of Hezekiah the bandit chief? Menachem's messianic assumption was, for his followers, merely the realization of the prophecies, the final step in ushering in the last days. That is not how Eleazar the temple captain saw it. He and his associates among the lower priests were incensed at what they viewed as a blatant power grab by the Sicarii. They put together a plan to kill the self-proclaimed Messiah and rid the city of his meddlesome followers. While Menachem was prancing about the temple in his royal garb, Eleazar's men suddenly rushed the temple mount and overpowered his guards. They dragged Menachem out into the open and tortured him to death. The surviving Sicarii barely fled Jerusalem with their lives. They reassembled at their base atop the fortress of Masada, where they waited out the rest of the war. 7 years the Sicarii waited. As the Romans regrouped and returned to wrest Palestine from rebel control, as one after another the towns and villages of Judea and Galilee were razed and their populations tamed by the sword, as Jerusalem itself was surrounded and its inhabitants slowly starved to death, the Sicarii waited in their mountain fortress. Only after every rebellious city had been destroyed and the land once again placed under their control did the Romans turn their sights toward Masada. The Roman regiment arrived at the foot of Masada in 73 CE, 3 years after Jerusalem fell. Because the soldiers could not attack the fortress outright, they first built a massive wall around the entire base of the mountain, ensuring that no rebel could escape undetected. With the area secured, the Romans constructed a steep ramp up the yawning chasm on the western side of the cliff face, slowly scraping away tens of thousands of pounds of earth and stone for weeks on end, even as the rebels hurled rocks at them from above. The soldiers then pushed a huge siege tower up the ramp, from which they spent days bombarding the rebels with arrows and ballista balls. Once Herod's perimeter wall finally gave, all that separated the Romans from the last of the Jewish rebels was a hurriedly built interior wall. The Romans set fire to the wall, then returned to their encampments and waited patiently for it to collapse on its own. Huddled together inside Herod's palace, the Sicarii knew the end had come. The Romans would surely do to them and their families what they had done to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Amid the steely silence, one of the Sicarii leaders stood and addressed the rest. "My friends, since we have resolved long ago never to be servants to the Romans, nor to any other than to God himself, who alone is the true and just Lord of mankind, the time has now come to make that resolution true in practice." Drawing his dagger, he made a final plea. "God has granted us the power to die bravely, and in a state of freedom, which was not the case for those who were conquered unexpectedly." The speech had its desired effect. As the Romans prepared for their final assault on Masada, the rebels drew lots among them to decide the order with which they would proceed with their gruesome plan. They then pulled out their daggers, the same daggers that had given them their identity, the daggers that had, with a swipe across the high priest's throat, launched the ill-fated war with Rome, and began to kill their wives and their children, before turning the knives upon each other. The last 10 men chose one among them to kill the remaining 9. The final man set the entire palace ablaze. Then he killed himself. The following morning, as the Romans stood triumphantly atop the hitherto impregnable fortress of Masada, all they encountered was a ghostly calm. 960 dead men, women, and children. The war was finally over. The question is why it took so long. News of the Jewish revolt had traveled swiftly to Emperor Nero, who immediately tapped one of his most trusted men, Titus Flavius Vespasianus, Vespasian, as he was known, to retake Jerusalem. Taking command of a massive army of more than 60,000 fighting men, Vespasian set off at once for Syria, while his son Titus went to Egypt to collect the Roman legion stationed in Alexandria. Titus would lead his troops north through Idumea, as Vespasian pushed south into Galilee. The plan was for father and son to squeeze the Jews between their two armies and choke the life out of the rebellion. One by one, the rebellious cities gave way to the might of Rome, as Titus and Vespasian carved a trail of destruction across the Holy Land. By 68 CE, all of Galilee, as well as Samaria, Idumea, Perea, and the Dead Sea region, save for Masada, were firmly back under Roman control. All that remained was for Vespasian to send his armies into Judea and lay waste to the seat of the rebellion, Jerusalem. As he was preparing for the final assault, however, Vespasian received word that Nero had committed suicide. Rome was in turmoil. Civil war was tearing through the capital. In the span of a few short months, three different men, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, declared themselves emperor, each in turn violently overthrown by his successor. There was a complete breakdown of law and order in Rome as thieves and hooligans plundered the population without fear of consequence. Not since the war between Octavian and Mark Antony 100 years earlier had the Romans experienced such civil unrest. Tacitus described it as a period, quote, rich in disasters, terrible with battles, torn by civil struggles, horrible even in peace. Spurred by the legions under his command, Vespasian halted his campaign in Judea and hastened to Rome to stake his own claim to the throne. The haste, it seems, was unnecessary. Long before he reached the capital in the summer of 70 CE, his supporters had taken control of the city, murdered his rivals, and declared Vespasian sole emperor. Yet the Rome that Vespasian now found himself ruling had undergone a profound transformation. The mass civil unrest had given rise to a great deal of consternation about the decline of Roman power and influence. The situation in distant Judea was particularly galling. It was bad enough that the lowly Jews had rebelled in the first place. It was inconceivable that after 3 long years, the rebellion still had not been crushed. Other subject peoples revolted, of course, but these were not Gauls or Britons. They were superstitious peasants hurling rocks. The very scale of the Jewish revolt, and the fact that it had come at a time of profound social and political distress in Rome, had created something akin to an identity crisis among the Roman citizenry. Vespasian knew that to consolidate his authority and address the malaise that had descended upon Rome, he needed to focus the people's attention away from their domestic troubles and toward a spectacular foreign conquest. A small victory would not do. What the emperor required was an absolute pummeling of an enemy force. He needed a triumph, a fabulous display of Roman might, replete with captives, slaves, and spoils, to win over his disgruntled citizens and strike terror into the hearts of his subjects. And so, immediately upon taking the throne, Vespasian set out to complete the task he had left unfinished in Judea. He would not simply quash the Jewish rebellion. That would be insufficient to make his point. He would utterly annihilate the Jews. He would wipe them from the earth, devastate their lands, burn their temple, destroy their cult, kill their god. From his perch in Rome, Vespasian sent word to his son Titus to march at once to Jerusalem and spare no expense in bringing the rebellion of the Jews to a swift and decisive end. What the emperor could not have known was that the rebellion was on the verge of collapsing on its own. Not long after Menachem was murdered and the Sicarii banished from Jerusalem, the rebels began preparing for the Roman invasion they were certain was on the horizon. The walls surrounding the city were fortified, and preparations were made to gather as much military equipment as was available. Swords and arrows were collected, suits of armor forged, catapults and ballista balls stacked along the city's perimeter. Young boys were hurriedly trained in hand-to-hand combat. The whole city was in a panic as the rebels manned their positions and waited for the Romans to return and reclaim Jerusalem. But the Romans never came. The rebels were certainly aware of the devastation taking place around them. Every day a horde of bruised and bloodied refugees poured into Jerusalem. The city was bursting at its borders. But the Roman reprisals were thus far focused solely on the countryside and the major rebel strongholds, such as Tiberias, Gamala, and Giscala. The longer the rebels waited for the Romans to arrive in Jerusalem, the more fractured and unstable the city's leadership became. Early on, a transitional government of sorts had formed, made up mostly of those among Jerusalem's priestly aristocracy who had joined the rebellion, many of them reluctantly. This so-called moderate faction was in favor of coming to terms with Rome, if that was still possible. They wanted to surrender unconditionally, beg for mercy, and submit once more to Roman rule. The moderates enjoyed a good deal of support in Jerusalem, particularly among the wealthier Jews who were looking for a way to preserve their status and property, not to mention their lives. But an even larger and more vocal faction in Jerusalem was convinced that God had led the Jews into war against Rome, and God would lead them to victory. Things may have seemed bleak at the moment and the enemy invincible, but that was part of God's divine plan. Did not the prophets warn that in the final days the sown places shall appear unsown and the storehouses shall be found empty? Yet if the Jews would only remain loyal to the Lord, then very soon they would see Jerusalem clothed in glory. The trumpets would sound, and all who heard them would be struck with fear. The mountains would flatten, and the earth would open up to swallow God's enemies. All that was required was faithfulness. Faithfulness and zeal. At the head of this camp was a coalition of peasants, lower-class priests, bandit gangs, and recently arrived refugees who came together to form a distinct revolutionary faction called the Zealot Party. Poor, pious, and anti-aristocratic, the members of the Zealot Party wanted to remain true to the original intention of the revolt, to purify the Holy Land and establish God's rule on earth. They were violently opposed to the transitional government and its plans to surrender the city to Rome. This was blasphemy. It was treason. And the Zealot Party knew well the punishment for both. The Zealot Party took over the temple's inner courtyard, where only the priests were permitted, and from there unleashed a wave of terror against those they deemed insufficiently loyal to the rebellion: the wealthy aristocracy and upper-class Jews, the old Herodian nobles and the temple's former leadership, the chief priests and all those who followed the moderate camp. The leaders of the Zealot Party set up their own shadow government and drew lots to determine which of them would serve as the next high priest. The lot fell to an illiterate country peasant named Fanny, son of Samuel, who was dressed up in the high priest's gaudy vestments placed before the entrance of the Holy of Holies and taught how to perform the sacrifices, while the remnants of the priestly nobility watched from a distance, weeping at what they perceived to be the desecration of their holy lineage. As the bloodshed and internecine battles between rival groups continued, even more refugees began to flood into the city, adding fuel to the fires of factionalism and discord that threatened to engulf all of Jerusalem. With the moderate silence, there were now three principal camps vying with one another for control over the city. While the Zealot Party, which consisted of about 2,500 men, held the inner court of the temple, the outer courts fell into the hands of the former leader of the rebellion in Giscala, a well-to-do urbanite named John, who had barely escaped the Roman destruction of his city. At first, John of Giscala threw in his lot with the Zealot Party, with whom he shared a devotion to the religious principles of the revolution. Whether John himself could be called a zealot is difficult to say. He was undoubtedly a fierce nationalist, with a deep hatred of Rome, at a time in which national sentiment and messianic expectation were inextricably linked. He even melted down the sacred vessels of the temple and turned them into implements of war with which to fight the armies of Rome. But a fight over control of the temple ultimately forced John to break with the Zealot Party and form his own coalition, which consisted of some 6,000 fighting men. The third and largest rebel camp in Jerusalem was led by Simon son of Giora, one of the bandit leaders who fought off the initial assault on Jerusalem. Simon had spent the first years of the Jewish revolt scouring the Judean countryside, plundering the lands of the wealthy, setting slaves free, and earning a reputation as the champion of the poor. After a brief stay with the Sicarii in Masada, Simon came to Jerusalem with a massive personal army of 10,000 men. At first, the city welcomed him, hoping he could rein in the excesses of the Zealot Party and clip the wings of John of Giscala, who was becoming increasingly authoritarian in his conduct. Although Simon was unable to wrest the temple from either of his rivals, he did manage to seize control over most of the upper and lower city. Yet what truly set Simon apart from the rest of the rebel leaders in Jerusalem is that, from the very beginning, he unabashedly presented himself as Messiah and king. Like Menachem before him, Simon dressed himself in kingly robes and paraded about the city as its savior. He declared himself master of Jerusalem and used his divinely anointed position to begin rounding up and executing the upper-class Jews whom he suspected of treason. As a result, Simon, son of Giora, ultimately came to be recognized as the supreme commander of the fractured rebellion, and just in time. For no sooner had Simon consolidated his authority over the rest of the rebel groups than Titus appeared at the city gates, with 4 Roman legions in tow, demanding Jerusalem's immediate surrender. All at once, the factionalism and feuding among the Jews gave way to frantic preparations for the impending Roman assault. But Titus was in no hurry to attack. Instead, he ordered his men to build a stone wall around Jerusalem, trapping everyone inside and cutting off all access to food and water. He then set up camp on the Mount of Olives, from which he had an unobstructed view of the city's population as they slowly starved to death. The famine that ensued was horrible. Entire families perished in their homes. The alleys were filled with the bodies of the dead. There was no room and no strength to bury them properly. The inhabitants of Jerusalem crawled through the sewers searching for food. People ate cow dung and tufts of dry grass. They stripped off and chewed the leather from their belts and shoes. There were scattered reports of Jews who succumbed to eating the dead. Those who attempted to escape the city were easily captured and crucified on the Mount of Olives for all to see. It would have been sufficient for Titus to simply wait for the population to perish on their own. He would not have needed to unsheathe his sword to defeat Jerusalem and end the rebellion. But that is not what his father had sent him there to do. His task was not to starve the Jews into submission. It was to eradicate them from the land they claimed as their own. Thus, in late April of 70 CE, as death stalked the city and the population perished by the hundreds from hunger and thirst, Titus rallied his legions and stormed Jerusalem. The Romans threw up ramparts along the walls of the upper city and began bombarding the rebels with heavy artillery. They constructed a massive battering ram that easily breached the first wall surrounding Jerusalem. When the rebels retreated to a second interior wall, that too was breached, and the gates set on fire. As the flames slowly died down, the city was laid bare for Titus's troops. The soldiers set upon everyone, man, woman, child, the rich, the poor, those who had joined in the rebellion, those who had remained faithful to Rome, the aristocrats, the priests, it made no difference. They burned everything. The whole city was ablaze. The roar of the flames mixed with screams of agony as the Roman swarm swept through the upper and lower city, littering the ground with corpses, sloshing through streams of blood, literally clamoring over heaps of dead bodies in pursuit of the rebels, until finally the temple was in their sights. With the last of the rebel fighters trapped inside the inner courtyard, the Romans set the entire foundation aflame, making it seem as though the Temple Mount was boiling over at its base with blood and fire. The flames enveloped the Holy of Holies, the dwelling place of the God of Israel, and brought it crashing to the ground in a pile of ash and dust. When the fires finally subsided, Titus gave orders to raze what was left of the city so that no future generation would even remember the name Jerusalem. Thousands perished, though Simon, son of Giora, Simon, the failed Messiah, was taken alive so that he could be dragged back to Rome in chains for the triumph that Vespasian had promised his people. Along with Simon came the sacred treasures of the temple, the golden table and the showbread offered to the Lord, the lampstand and the 7-branched menorah, the incense burners and cups, the trumpets and holy vessels. All of these were carried in triumphal procession through the streets of Rome, as Vespasian and Titus, crowned with laurels and clad in purple robes, watched in silent resolution. Finally, at the end of the procession, the last of the spoils was carried out for all to see, a copy of the Torah, the supreme symbol of the Jewish religion. Vespasian's point was hard to miss. This was a victory not over a people, but over their God. It was not Judea, but Judaism that had been defeated. Titus publicly presented the destruction of Jerusalem as an act of piety and an offering to the Roman gods. It was not he who had accomplished the task, Titus claimed. He had merely given his arms to his God, who had shown his anger against the God of the Jews. Remarkably, Vespasian chose to waive the customary practice of evocatio, whereby a vanquished enemy had the option of worshipping its god in Rome. Not only would the Jews be forbidden to rebuild their temple, a right offered to nearly every other subject people in the empire, they would now be forced to pay a tax of 2 drachmas a year, the exact amount Jewish men once paid in shekels to the temple in Jerusalem, in order to help rebuild the temple of Jupiter, which was accidentally burned down during the Roman Civil War. All Jews, no matter where in the empire they lived, no matter how loyal they had remained to Rome, no matter if they had taken part in the rebellion or not, every Jew, including women and children, was now forced to pay for the upkeep of the central pagan cult of Rome. Henceforth, Judaism would no longer be deemed a worthy cult. The Jews were now the eternal enemy of Rome. Although mass population transfer had never been a Roman policy, Rome expelled every surviving Jew from Jerusalem and its surrounding environs, ultimately renamed the city Aelia Capitolina, and placed the entire region under direct imperial control. All of Palestine became Vespasian's personal property, as the Romans strove to create the impression that there had never been any Jews in Jerusalem. By the year 135 CE, the name Jerusalem ceased to exist in all official Roman documents. For those Jews who survived the bloodbath, those huddled naked and starved beyond the collapsed city walls, watching in horror as the Roman soldiers urinated on the smoldering ashes of the house of God, it was perfectly clear who was to blame for the death and devastation. Surely it was not the Lord of hosts who had brought such destruction upon the sacred city. No, it was the Lestai, the bandits and the rebels, the zealots and the Sicarii, the nationalist revolutionaries who had preached independence from Rome, the so-called prophets and false messiahs who had promised salvation from God in return for their fealty and zeal. They were the ones responsible for the Roman onslaught. They were the ones whom God had abandoned. In the years to come, the Jews would begin to distance themselves as much as possible from the revolutionary idealism that had led to the war with Rome. They would not altogether abandon their apocalyptic expectations. On the contrary, a flourish of apocalyptic writings would emerge over the next century, reflecting the continued longing for divine deliverance from Roman rule. The lingering effects of this messianic fervor would even lead to the outbreak of a brief second Jewish war against Rome in 132 CE, this one led by the Messiah known as Simon, son of Kochba. For the most part, however, the rabbis of the second century would be compelled by circumstance and by fear of Roman reprisal to develop an interpretation of Judaism that eschewed nationalism. They would come to view the Holy Land in more transcendental terms, fostering a messianic theology that rejected overt political ambitions, as acts of piety and the study of the law took the place of temple sacrifices in the life of the observant Jew. But that was all many years away. On this day, the day in which the beaten and bloodied remnants of the ancient Jewish nation were wrenched from their homes, their temple, their God, and forcibly marched out of the Promised Land to the land of the heathens and idolaters, all that seemed certain was that the world as they knew it had come to an end. Meanwhile, in triumphant Rome, a short while after the temple of the Lord had been desecrated, the Jewish nation scattered to the winds, and the religion made a pariah. Tradition says a Jew named John Mark took up his quill and composed the first words to the first gospel written about the Messiah known as Jesus of Nazareth, not in Hebrew, the language of God, nor in Aramaic, the language of Jesus, but in Greek, the language of the heathens, the language of the impure, the language of the victors. This is the beginning of the good news of Jesus the Christ. Part 2. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and release to the prisoners who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and the day of vengeance for our God. Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2. Prologue. Zeal for your house. Of all the stories told about the life of Jesus of Nazareth, there is one, depicted in countless plays, films, paintings, and Sunday sermons, that, more than any other word or deed, helps reveal who Jesus was and what Jesus meant. It is one of only a handful of events in Jesus' ministry attested to by all four canonized Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, adding some measure of weight to its historicity. Yet all four evangelists present this monumental moment in a casual, almost fleeting manner, as though they were either oblivious to its meaning or, more likely, deliberately downplaying an episode whose radical implications would have been immediately recognized by all who witnessed it. So revelatory is this single moment in Jesus' brief life that it alone can be used to clarify his mission, his theology, his politics, his relationship to the Jewish authorities, his relationship to Judaism in general, and his attitude toward the Roman occupation. Above all, this singular event explains why a simple peasant from the low hills of Galilee was seen as such a threat to the established system that he was hunted down, arrested, tortured, and executed. The year is approximately 30 CE. Jesus has just entered Jerusalem, riding a donkey and flanked by a frenzied multitude shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed be the coming kingdom of our father David." The ecstatic crowd sings hymns of praise to God. Some spread cloaks on the road for Jesus to ride over, just as the Israelites did for Jehu when he was declared king. Others saw off palm branches and waved them in the air, in remembrance of the heroic Maccabees who liberated Israel from foreign rule 2 centuries earlier. The entire pageant has been meticulously orchestrated by Jesus and his followers in fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy. "Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Cry out, daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and victorious is he, humble and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the son of a donkey." Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. The message conveyed to the city's inhabitants is unmistakable. The long-awaited Messiah, the true King of the Jews, has come to free Israel from its bondage. As provocative as his entrance into Jerusalem may be, it pales in comparison to what Jesus does the following day. With his disciples and, one assumes, the praiseful multitude in tow, Jesus enters the temple's public courtyard, the court of Gentiles, and sets about cleansing it. In a rage, he overturns the tables of the money changers and drives out the vendors hawking cheap food and souvenirs. He releases the sheep and cattle ready to be sold for sacrifice and breaks open the cages of the doves and pigeons, setting the birds to flight. "Take these things out of here," he shouts. With the help of his disciples, he blocks the entrance to the courtyard, forbidding anyone carrying goods for sale or trade from entering the temple. Then, as the crowd of vendors, worshippers, priests, and curious onlookers scramble over the scattered detritus, as a stampede of frightened animals, chased by their panicked owners, rushes headlong out of the temple gates and into the choked streets of Jerusalem. As a corps of Roman guards and heavily armed temple police blitz through the courtyard, looking to arrest whoever is responsible for the mayhem, there stands Jesus, according to the Gospels, aloof,